Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Message Podcast of Friends Church. My name is Gregory and I'm one of the team members here, and we're so glad that you're joining us. It's been really encouraging to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening in. We really do hope that our messages are resonating with you. We also wanted to say a quick thank you to those who are contributing to Friends Church. All of the things that we're able to do is because of people who donate regularly. Even small, consistent gifts help a lot. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that, especially if it's been beneficial in your journey. To do that, it's really easy. Just go to the website, friendschurch.ca, and click the Donate tab. Or better yet, download our Friends Church app and click on the Give tab. Thanks so much for tuning in, and enjoy this week's message.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Or Happy New Year's, or whatever the appropriate greeting is for today. Does anyone actually know? I've asked all of you. What's the appropriate greeting for this period of time? You guys are no help. So welcome. Happy New Year's. Because it kind of feels like this is the beginning of the end of this year, isn't it? Like this week is kind of that ramp up. It's kind of a nice ramp. Because this is the time where we start thinking about things like, well, what's next year going to look like? Or maybe we evaluate this year and think, how did I do this year? It's like a solid 4 out of 10. All the way through this season, I've been asking myself this kind of weird question. How do we make change in our lives? Right? This is the season where we're going to start doing things like New Year's resolutions. You look back at your year, kind of go, okay, that one, that didn't go well, but that went really well. And then we start looking at the new year going, okay, well, what would I like this next year to be? I was just talking to somebody who said, you know, now that I can do anything, what am I going to do this next year? It's like blank slate. In order to make change for the next year, the question I want to ask is, what causes us to change things in our lives? What do we need? And more importantly, what causes changes to stick? Not just, I'm going to get fit this year, and by January like 15th, you're out of the gym and you're never going back. How is it that we're going to do something that's going to last our whole year? There's a story to me that kind of captures this. It's about a guy named Samuel Finley Breeze Morris. He was born on April 27th, 1791. He was a smarty pants. Studied at Yale and a bunch of other big schools. And while he was studying at the school, he needed to pay for his education. And so what he did is he started painting. Like not wall painting, but portraits. And he was really good. He's that kind of Renaissance man, you know, who can, you know, do math and also is a portrait painter, and he's probably good looking too, I don't know. But he's that guy. And so he starts painting these portraits to get himself through school. And on the way, he meets his wife, Anne. They fall desperately in love. They have two kids, one on the way. He's now studied at some of the biggest art schools. His career kind of took a shift from, you know, magnetics and math and all that stuff to painting. He became a professional painter. And so here's this couple, two kids. He's supporting them just by painting portraits, and he gets a call to paint the General Lafayette, French general who supports the French Revolution. So FYI, if you're not a history buff, which I'm not, this is a big deal. This guy's a big deal. And so, of course, what he does is he grabs all his paints and he rushes. Now, I used to be married to an artist. Let me just tell you, art is not the most solidly funded thing, a career in the world. When someone says, I will pay you to paint, you drop everything and go. It doesn't matter if you haven't slept in a week. You go. And so he shoves all his paints in his box, jumps on a horse, rides 6 days to New York City. Sits down with the general. And while he's painting the general, something happens. A courier comes late one evening, says a note from his dad. And it says one line. Your wife is convalescent. Now, he loved his wife desperately. She's pregnant with their third child. He's 6 days away. And he gets this note saying, your wife is sick. He basically stops the portrait, throws his paints back in this thing, jumps on a horse, and starts hoofing it 6 days home. As he gets closer to home, the feeling of dread starts to build in him. In fact, as he's coming up the lane to their house, it's like he knows there's something wrong. Something's not right. Instead of being greeted by his wife at the door, he finds out that his wife's died. In fact, before he got the message saying she was sick, she was already dead. And instead of being able to be there with his wife to say goodbye and to hold her hand and to tell her he loved her one last time, he's left with nothing. Her body's already buried. There's nothing to do. What a brutal story, isn't it? I don't tell you this story because it's a heart, like, gets your heart, although it, to me, this one gets me. I tell you this story because of the change he created in Samuel Finley Breeze Morris. He was so devastated by missing his wife, not being able to say goodbye to her, not being able to finish their relationship in a way that felt okay to him. He was so devastated by that, everything in his life changed. He quit painting. He went back to school. In fact, he became an inventor. And in the next 30 years, he dedicated himself to a single goal. He dedicated them to a technology that would say, no one will ever miss the death of a loved one because the message came too late. You see, Samuel Finley Breeze Morris is better known for Morse code. And he co-invented the telegraph lines. And suddenly, information wasn't at the speed of a horse, at the speed of somebody who could ride to bring you a message. Suddenly, it was instantaneous. For him, the catalyst moment was saying, I don't want anyone to ever miss the death of a loved one again. And his whole life changed. What are the moments in our lives that catalyze us to change? What are the stories that impact us? And there's a story like his, you know, Morse code, like, geez, it's a crazy story, right? I heard it, first heard it on the podcast, The Memory Palace. Anyone Memory Palace fans? It's a gooder, huh? But not all of our stories are that big. I was 16 years old, and I was with my aunt. We were doing this road trip. My mom's twin. So we were doing this road trip to BC. I was 16. I had nothing better to do. I thought, road trip? That sounds fun. And we're driving into a little place called Caslow, BC. It's kind of like in the middle of nowhere. But you have to go across a ferry to get across the Kootenay Lake, right at Crawford Bay. Anyone know the ferry? Yeah, I'm from the prairies, so we don't really have ferries. So we hop onto this ferry, you know, you pull your car in, and I sat up on the upper deck because all you do is wait now. And as I sat there, I remember this moment, and like I can literally close my eyes, and it's right there. There's a couple on what looked like big dirt bikes. It's a bike you can ride on the road and also in dirt. It's called a dual sport bike. They're KLRs. They had these like homemade toolboxes strapped to the bottom of them. These people looked like they've lived in their clothes. They slept in their clothes for like weeks. They were the hardest core people I'd ever seen in my life. And I was in love. And I looked at that bike. Anywhere you want to go in our part of the world, if there's one vehicle that can take you there, that's the thing that's going to take you there. And I swore that day, I will own a dual sport bike at some point in my life. Went to school, was dirt-ass poor, saved every penny I could. Finally, I bought my first dirt bike. Called her Bertha. Do you have a picture for me? Oh, yeah. See, like, even have the toolbox strapped to the bottom just like they did. I rode that thing everywhere. When I got it, it was totally beat up. I beat it even worse. I rode it all the way around Vancouver Island, around Utah, Colorado, Washington, Arizona. I rode it to Mexico and back on gravel roads. I rode that thing everywhere. Why? Because a moment on a ferry in BC and said, that's what I want to do. What are the catalyst moments in your life? Sometimes they're big. You know, your wife dies and you miss the message. Holy crap. Sometimes there are these random moments of being on a ferry someplace and seeing someone's life and going, I want that. Sometimes it's even simpler. You go to the doctor and they say, your blood pressure's not good. Like, okay. It's enough of a story for me. What is it that's caused you to change? This next series, we're talking about change. We're talking about what does it look like to be healthier? So let me ask you the question. What in your life could be healthier? We just came off Christmas, so I'm going to definitely put diet on my list. I ate more than a human should. What about your spiritual life? Emotional health? How's your mental game? What parts of your life, when you look back at this year, you go, you know what? If that part of my life was healthier, that would be a good thing. At some point in this journey, some point in this next month, I hope, something is going to catalyze you to change. There'll be a story, a vision. You'll think of like, oh, I'm going to go on a holiday, or I want to, you know, there's a mountain that I want to climb. And suddenly you're doing all these different things in your life to try and get there. I want to lose weight. I want to have more clarity in my life. Be a better parent, better partner. Some part of you that says, if I had more health there, not only would my life be better, the world around me would be better. And there's going to be a catalyst moment, almost always. There will be some moment that you go, that was the thing that got me to start making a change. There'll be some story that catalyzes you into change. And usually here's what we think. I have the catalyst moment. I'm on a ferry in BC. I see a dual sport bike. My life should change, right? I'm part of a gym. Me and my buddy have been climbing there. Probably I've climbed with her for maybe 12 years. We take January off because we try and, you know, our bodies need a little recovery time. Because all the people who have New Year's resolutions come in January, and by February 1st, they're all gone. We have the gym to ourselves again. Right? We have a catalyst moment, something in this time of the year we go, I'm going to do this, or I saw that, or you're in the mall and some parent is just has this like incredibly ninja parent moment with their kids, and you go, how do they even do that? I got up my parenting game. There'll be some moment, but here's the deal, and here's why I want to talk about this message. The catalyst moment isn't enough. It's not. It's needed. It's needed to get things started, but it's not enough. There's a guy named Paul. Actually, his name originally in this story is Saul. He's walking down the road, persecuting Christians. Persecuting, is that a common word? Yeah. You know, like arresting them and like hassling them. That's what he's doing. And he's walking down the road, and suddenly a light flashes into his eyes, and he has a divine moment. It's the Bible, so just go with it. Thin place, whatever. I don't know if it actually happened. I don't know if it happened inside of him. But something so profound hit him in that moment that he changed everything. Everything. From the biggest persecutor of Christianity to the biggest advocate. He wrote half of the New Testament. In fact, it was such a big change. This catalyst event was so big that his name wouldn't work anymore. He started off, his name was Saul. After this moment, he's like, yep, Saul's just not cutting it anymore. I got to give a new name. He's going to call me Paul. Can you imagine that? You have a moment where you're like, I finished the marathon. I'm now going to be called Frank. You're like, what is up with that? But that's how big the change is. Like, everything in his life has changed. Everything. The catalyst moment, like, it's bigger than you can even imagine. And yet, here's what he says only a little while later. It's a couple years after this. He says this, I want to do what's right, but I can't. I want to do what's good, but I don't. I don't want to do what's wrong, but I do it anyways. Catalyst moment where he literally is so changed that his name doesn't fit anymore. Year later, he's like, yeah, I suck. Anyone have one of those moments? I'm going to eat healthy. And suddenly I'm sitting at McDonald's with a Big Mac in my mouth going, this is really tasty. There's something going on for us. We need these catalyst moments to make these changes, but they don't last. The catalyst moment isn't enough. And today I want to talk about how to make it enough. How to get it to stick. How to get our lives healthier and stay healthier, not just for January, not just for, you know, the first 2 weeks in February, but for the rest of our lives. Because to me, there's profound spirituality when we can make healthy, positive changes that stick and spread into our world. Okay, I don't know if we get to do three-point sermons. Today you're going to get a three-point sermon. Nod your heads. Three-point sermons, yay. First point. I was in Edmonton. I used to live in Edmonton. Lovely city, right on White Ave. And I used to go to this same video rental store because that's how old I am. And there's a Baskin-Robbins. It's not there anymore. I drove by it the other day. But there's a Baskin-Robbins in the corner. And I always saw these three ladies sitting in Baskin-Robbins in their running gear eating ice cream. And my feeling was exactly your all feeling. I was like, have you done the math? Like, you ran and now you ate and you're basically losing the plot. But I think I'm missing something here. And I think we often miss something. There's this idea, or maybe a metaphor, that we don't have a single brain. Anyone have this moment where you're at the same time feeling like going for a walk or going for a run and also feeling like sitting on the couch? At the literally the same time. How does that work? The idea is there's multiple little brains inside of our brain that are all talking to us. And they all want different things. The one that wants me to be healthy wants me to go for a run. The one that wants me to be lazy wants me to sit on the couch. The one that wants me to conserve calories is going, you realize if you run, we have to eat a whole lot more, and that's just a waste of our time. There's all these brains inside of us that are all talking to us. And here's what happens most of the time when you want to make a change. You have a catalyst moment. Okay, I am going to eat healthy. No more McDonald's, Vince. And then the part of my brain that says, Vince, you're going to eat healthy, suddenly gets quieter, and the part of my brain that says, I'm really freaking hungry and I'm passing McDonald's right now, gets really, really loud, right? And next thing I know, I'm in the drive-thru. The part of my brain that still wants me to eat healthy is still there. It's just not as loud as the part that's saying, I'm really freaking hungry and there's McDonald's right there. Here's the deal. Most of the time when we make change, we work with one little brain inside of us. Right? I want to be a good parent. That's the part of your brain. You're not looking at, have I had enough sleep? How are me and my partner doing? You know, what's my long-term self-care? How's my stress levels? You're not looking at those brains. You're just looking at one brain saying, I want to be a good parent. And thinking that that brain is going to trump all the other little brains that have all sorts of different agendas. So here's my point here. Actually, I'll tell you this way. So I want to learn to dance. That's a joke, people. I am a 47-year-old Mennonite who's never danced a day in his life. I want to learn to dance. True story. There's a part of my brain, there's one little brain inside of me that's like, dude, you can totally be the next John Travolta. You are going to kill it. There's another very important part of my brain that's, I'm going to call the social police, is saying, you will not get up in front of anyone and dance or I will kill you. So I want to learn to dance. How long do you think I can get the social police to shut it for? Like the first time I'm twerking in front of like a group of people, it's going to be like, yeah, you're done. You're done. You're out. So how do we do this? Here's what you do. Here's what the research says. You work with all parts of your brain. Those ladies who ran said, hey, I want to run, but I also want to sit and have something delicious and hang out with my friends and visit. They were holistic. They were working with all parts of their brain. So what about me? I want to dance. I can't dance. Look at how long my arms are. I could take people's eyes out. So how do I get the social police in my head to calm down? Well, first, maybe like the drop-in dance class where everyone of all different levels can go and dance, and I've never danced a day in my life, maybe that's not going to work for me, right? What if I signed up for the rookie class, like the 47-year-old Mennonite can't dance rookie class, right? The social police in my head saying, okay, I like where you're going with this. What if I went to the dance class run by the nice senior citizen gentleman who's danced his whole life and he's nice to everybody, not the 20-year-old Latin sex symbol who's like, makes me look like a chump, right? What if I sprung for some private lessons to get me up to the speed where I'm not killing people while I'm trying to dance? Do you see how as I talk this through, the part of me that wants to dance is still there, but the other part of me is going, okay, I like where you're going with this. Okay, private lessons so you don't look like a chump. Okay, we can work with this. Any change you make, there will be part of your brain that says, yes, let's do this. And there will be another part or many parts that say, this doesn't really fit our agenda. How do you negotiate with all of your brain? How do you get it all on board? Or at least as much as you can. Maybe you want to get physically healthy, you want to train for a half marathon. New shoes, right? The part of your body that's saying, running is just too abusive on our body, we can't do that. What if I get new shoes that have really good cushion? Oh, okay, I like where you're going with that. New outfit that's comfortable, maybe an outfit that looks good. Maybe you promise yourself that you'll run inside on cold days. When I used to run long, the way I talked my brain into it is I said, okay, I want to run long. And then part of my brain's like, okay, I'm bored already. So I said to the bored part of the brain, what if I run in the mountains every time I do a long run? Okay, beautiful, good scenery. Yeah, that'll work. When you make a change, there's a part of your brain that says, I want this, but there's another part that says, I don't. How are you negotiating with that part of your brain? Often, to the degree you are able to get all of your brain on board is the degree of how long that change will last. Make sense? Align all your brain. Second point. I love 12 steppers. I know we have some, please don't put up your hand, but I just want to say huge respect to y'all. You guys have taught me so much about how life works. One of the things that 12 steppers have taught me is this. When you go to 12-step, by definition, you're trying to stop something. There's a part of your brain that says, I want to be sober from X. But they don't just kind of stay on that. They say this. Okay, you want to get sober? Great. What's your relapse plan? Have you ever spent time thinking about how you're going to screw up the change you want to make? They have you sit down and plan, when I completely screw this whole thing up, how am I going to recover from that? Right? When I'm sitting at McDonald's with a Big Mac in my mouth and going, okay, we're off the wagon now, folks. What do I do? Is it like, well, order some fries while I'm here? Right? How many times do we fall off the wagon and then just run down the mountain? It's just like, I am going to go so off the rails on this one. Because we have no plan on how do we screw up. The idea is we'll never screw up. I don't remember the exact stats, but it's like a minuscule amount of people who become sober through 12-step actually do it in one shot and never fail. Almost everybody has at least one blip. And they're so incredible about it. I was talking with someone this week. He's like, no, you... If you, so say you don't want to drink and you find yourself at 3 o'clock in the morning at the bar with 12 beer in front of you, what do you do? You call your sponsor. The sponsor already has agreed to take the call whenever you call. You call at 3 o'clock in the morning from the bar, they take the call. And you have a plan. You say, okay, get home, get away from booze. Tomorrow we're going to meet up at 8 a.m. at a meeting. We're going to go to a meeting. We're going to get you back on track again. You see how it works? You make a change and then you screw it up. I'm going to read a book every day or every month this year, right? That's going to be my health goal. Your birthday happens and pretty soon, you know, you have the week-long party and now you're 6 chapters behind and you get to the end of the month and you haven't even read the book. What do you do? Do you throw the whole thing out? It's often what we do. But when you have a relapse plan, you go, okay, I get a freebie month this year. Or I'm going to call my friend and tell them, hey, look, I know we talked about this whole book thing. I am behind. Can we move things around? What do we need to do? How do we plan to fail? But more importantly, how do we plan to recover from the failure? Think about that health moment. I don't mean to bet against you, but chances are you're going to have a blip. Have you figured out a way to get back on the wagon quickly? My final point, 3. There's this idea in our head that we have an inner critic. So there's multiple parts of our brain. There's one that's particularly painful. You'll know this one because it never says anything good to you. You want to make a change? It'll tell you you can't do that. You tried that once before. You won't be able to do it. Who do you think you are? Screw you. You're not going to make that change. You're going to be worse next year than you are this year. It's the voice that says, you can't have a better life. It's the voice that remembers every failure you've ever done and always wants to tell you about your failures. You want to talk about something that's going to take you out of the game as you're trying to make healthy changes? That inner critic will take you out every time. Some people call it shame. Brené Brown's a researcher who researches shame. She says there's going to be a moment in most of your lives where that shame kicks in hard. I want to be stronger this year. I want to be more emotionally controlled, more emotionally available. I want to, whatever the healthy thing is. And the shame voice says, you can't do that. You will fail like you always fail. And what starts as a catalyst event and that has all these things behind it, you can just feel it just start to tank. You're right. I suck. This isn't going to work. So how do you deal with that voice? Brené has a story. It's actually a quote from a president. President Roosevelt says this. It's not the critic who counts. It's not that voice in your head. It's not the person who points out how the strong person stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the person who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But those who do actually strive to do the deeds, who know great enthusiasm and great devotion, who spend themselves in a worthy cause, who at the best know in the end the triumph of high achievement, and at the worst, if they fail, at least fails while daring greatly. We all have a moment to be in the arena of our lives. We can sit in this moment exactly how we are and do nothing different. We can let that voice tell us that there's nothing we can do. Who do we think we are? This is all we got. Or we can let those words by Brené say, will you dare greatly? Will you try? You will fail. Things will go badly. You'll fall off the wagon. But unless we dare greatly, there is no hope. So let me leave you with this. Where in your life this year do you need to dare greatly? Where do you need more health? Where do you need a life that's bigger and bolder? It's different. Where do you need to dare greatly? Without that, we will be who we are next year, the same as we are now. But if we're willing to put ourselves out there and to try something that might fail, it might go horribly wrong, if we're willing, we have a chance to make this world a better place. We have a chance to make our lives better. And that's what Friends Church is all about. If you're not sure where you need health, our next series is all about what you need to do. This is to remember how to do it. Catalyst event. Make sure all your brain's aligned. Have a relapse plan. And dare greatly. Have an incredible New Year's, you guys. We'll see you next Sunday. Take care.